Yeah, so today I want to talk about attempts to look for signatures of new physics at fairly high scales, hopefully close to but not quite at the grand unified scale, in details of the spectrum of fluctuations of the cosmic microwave background radiation. So I will start with a little introduction reminding people of the kinds of high scales one would be interested in to motivate this. I will then embark on a somewhat lengthy review of inflation and the production of fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, because those facts in this review will be what we use to talk about short distance physics. I will then finally get to the impact of new physics in general, the impact of new states at high energies, and discuss what particular impact they have on the story. I will then discuss what the actual signatures are that you would see in an experiment, and then finally discuss the observability of these effects in various models in string theory, M theory, and in field theory. And that's me. This work was done in collaboration with my friends and colleagues at Stanford, Nemanja Kaliper, Matthew Kleben, who's a student, and Steve Schenker, and it was published pretty recently. So just by way of review, string theory is generally meant to address two particular rather high dynamical scales if you adopt the sort of old school approach. There is the scale at which gravity becomes gravitational effects become strong and quantum gravitational.
One step back.
Yes. Quantum gravitational effects become important. Thank you. Which is about 10 to the 18th GeV, depending on your factors of 8 pi. And then there is the theory, then there is the scale at which, if one assumes supersymmetry above a TeV, the strong, weak, and electromagnetic couplings unify, which is at about 2 times 10 to the 16th GeV. And the first thing you notice straight away is that both of these scales are rather larger than a TeV, which is the scale you can access most directly via accelerator experiments. Now, in string theory, well, these days there are two frameworks generally that people use to try to explain these high scales. I will discuss the newer one first and then not really talk about it for the rest of the talk, except for one feature. One framework is the large extra dimensions framework, where one postulates that the fundamental dynamical scale of a theory, the scale of, among other things, quantum gravity, is at about a TeV, and one has a d-dimensional spacetime, and the four-dimensional Planck scale is derived. It's a result of the dimensional reduction of this d-dimensional theory. And so, for example, as everyone has, I'm sure, heard a million times, if one has the fundamental scale at a TeV and a six-dimensional theory to start with, the extra dimensions are about a millimeter. And one obvious nice thing about this is that one might be able to see then quantum gravity effects at the LHC. The one thing that I will use from this for the rest of this talk is this fact that the four-dimensional Planck scale is derived, but I won't be using quite this huge of a gap between different gravitational scales. In more conventional unified string models, one has strings with some tension set by the string scale. In conventional 10-dimensional string theories, the 10-dimensional manifold is our four-dimensional world times some small six-dimensional manifold, usually some kind of Calabi-Yau manifold. And the dynamical scales in such a theory are usually all at about or above the gut scale. In weakly coupled string models, the 10-dimensional Planck scale is a bit higher. But in all of these models, the four-dimensional Planck scale is still derived. And finally, in 11-dimensional M-theory models, where one takes the 11-dimensional manifold to be our spacetime times a 7-dimensional manifold, all of the dynamical scales are actually pretty close to the grand unified scale. The compactification is usually taken to either be a Calabi-Yau time, the warped product of a Calabi-Yau manifold and an interval, with E8 degrees of freedom propagating on the interval, the Herjavec-Witten model. And here, the only sort of large difference between scales is the difference between the length of this interval and the gut scale. Everything else is at about the gut scale. Whereas in compactifications on 7 manifolds with G2 holonomy, where the gauge dynamics lives on some 7-dimensional defect, all of the scales are within a factor of the 11-dimensional Planck scale, the size of the extra dimensions, et cetera, are all pretty close to the gut scale. So in these models, and generally, the gut scale, about 2 × 10^16 GeV, is really the important scale for new physics. Now, the question then, as I said before, is how to discuss this experimentally. One method is to do things very indirectly. For example, one can postulate some model at the gut scale, run the couplings down, and see what happens, and see if it matches what one actually observes at a TEV. One can also, in the framework of these models, wait a long time. In particular, proton decay occurs via exchanges in gut models, via exchanges of particles with very large masses. And so if you get enough of these particles and wait for a while, one might hope to see the proton decay, or at least set limits on its lifetime. And this latter, the combination of these two methods is non-trivial. It certainly rules out some of the simplest grand unified models. So these are really non-trivial constraints. They're just a little indirect. It's not like you're running an accelerator at the Planck scale. So another question is whether you can study processes which really occur at these high energy scales. And the tack we will take is to look for very high energy processes in the sky. In particular, in the simplest models of inflation, the energy density during the inflationary epoch can be as high as the gut scale to the fourth. And quantum fluctuations, which are generated at this time, are generated at energies about 10^14 GeV and lead eventually to the cosmic background anisotropies that we see. And they lead via gravitational collapse to the large-scale structure that we see, the galaxies and clusters of galaxies and so on. So you might hope to use these facts to say something experimentally about these very high energy scales. And one motivation for doing this now is that there's a host of new high-precision cosmic background experiments coming online. The microwave anisotropy probe is now taking data from space, a satellite launched by NASA. There's another satellite which will be hopefully launched by the Europeans in about 2007. These two experiments mostly map out the fluctuations in the temperature of the cosmic microwave background radiation, and they should be accurate down to the fundamental limits of sample variance, the fact that there's only one universe. And so when I try to look at the strength of the fluctuations on a particular angular scale, there are only so many measurements I can ever make. Next, there are also polarization measurements of the polarization of the cosmic microwave background radiation, which are being built. And those are also particularly important for the effects that I'm going to discuss. So hopefully, the combination of these measurements will allow will give us measurements which are sensitive to dynamics at either 10^14 GeV or up at mGut. So to see how, in particular, physics at these high scales might actually affect observations, I want to embark on a review of the origin of the cosmic microwave background radiation and the fluctuations in that radiation generated by quantum dynamics during inflation. So the basic idea is that when the universe is about 100,000 years old, the temperature of the universe was about an EV, or 10^4 degrees Kelvin. And above this temperature, just above this temperature, the universe was comprised of free electrons, nuclei, and photons. The photons couple strongly to the electrons and nuclei because they are charged and have a black body spectrum. At about this temperature, the electrons and the nuclei combine into neutral atoms, at the epoch known as recombination. At this point, because they are neutral, the photons don't couple to them as strongly, and they start propagating freely towards us, and they redshift as the universe expands. So by the time they get to us today, they've redshifted such that their spectrum is that of a 2.7 degree Kelvin blackbody. And this radiation is known as the cosmic microwave background radiation. Now, there's one thing you notice when you look at this radiation, which is that it's extremely uniform at all angular scales on the sky. On the other hand, as you look backwards, look farther and farther away, you're looking backwards in time. And if you look back to this recombination epoch, two objects which are separated by angular scales of about a degree on the sky were causally disconnected during recombination. Nonetheless, the cosmic microwave background radiation is pretty uniform at all angular scales on the sky. So this is pretty confusing from the standpoint of causality. On the other hand, you need a certain amount of structure in the cosmic background radiation, because density fluctuations at recombination lead eventually via gravitational collapse to the large-scale structure that we observe today, clusters of galaxies and so forth. And they also lead to temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background radiation that we actually observe. So we need to generate small density fluctuations in this at this time. On the other hand, they have to be pretty small, and they have to be pretty uniform. The standard scenario for doing this is inflation. It's certainly the scenario I will discuss today. And the basic idea is to assume that some cosmological constant like matter or energy dominates Einstein's equations when the universe is about 10 to the minus 38 seconds old. Because of this, the metric takes this De Sitter form, with this factor measuring the expansion rate of the universe being just the cosmological constant divided by the 40 Planck scale squared. And the basic feature of this metric is that two static objects, which are separated by delta x, expand away from each other rapidly. If they are separated by distances larger than 1 over h, known as the Hubble scale, they are causally disconnected. They separate superluminally. And small perturbations of any field or of the metric itself stretch out, like so, because of inflation. In particular, correlated objects rapidly separate because of the rapid expansion of spacetime. Because of this, if such a phase occurs so that the universe can grow by a factor of e to the 60, or the scale factor can grow by a factor of e to the 60 before this phase ends, this is about 10 to the minus 35 seconds, we can solve the horizon problem, and we also get a nice flat universe, which is precisely what we observe, because curvature is the result of variations of the metric, and those get stretched out. Of course, this phase can't last forever. Eventually, ordinary matter and radiation should dominate, as it Einstein's equations, as it does today. So the scenario, the traditional scenario for discussing inflation is to postulate a scalar field known as the inflaton, a simple Lagrangian like this, and a sufficiently shallow potential so that if one begins with a homogeneous vacuum expectation value for the scalar field, the change in the energy density during with time as the scalar field rolls down this potential hill is slow. And in particular, the kinetic energy in the inflaton is much smaller than the potential energy. These conditions are known as the slow roll conditions. And in this regime, the Hubble scale is simply related to the energy density, like so. and the inflaton evolves like so. Eventually, this phase must end, and in particular, when this gets to the bottom and starts sloshing back and forth, if the period of the sloshing is less than the expansion time, then this particle can decay into ordinary particles and standard cosmology begins. As I've said, this is a scenario for generating the extreme smoothness and homogeneity of the universe today, but we also have to generate structure. Fluctuations in the density and the temperature of the cosmic background radiation. And to do this, I just want to mention in passing what I mean by generations of wavelengths, because it's the dependent on fluctuations on wavelengths that I will use. If I measure the wavelength if I have this De Sitter metric and I measure the wavelength in these coordinates, x, this wavelength is known as the co-moving wavelength, and it's the co-moving momenta, which is in fact conserved in dynamical processes. As a result, if I measure this wavelength in proper distances, I measure it with this metric, and the physical wavelength will grow. If this wavelength is static, the physical wavelength grows by this expansion factor. So, and it's this, I will discuss things in terms of this physical wavelength. Now, the basic story, picture of generating density perturbations is that at wavelengths of order the Hubble scale, quantum fluctuations of the inflaton freeze into classical perturbations like so. This process is very similar to Hawking radiation, the generation of the emission of physical particles due to the presence of a horizon. And the amount, this size of these fluctuations is measured simply by the quantum two-point function at the scale lambda equals 1 over h. And in the simple model I've shown, it just takes this simple form. Eventually, these convert to density perturbations because we're rolling down a, crudely, because we're rolling down a hill, the slope of the potential is non-zero, so a fluctuation of the inflaton converts into a fluctuation of the energy density. This will back react on the metric, and so forth. Once these fluctuations are generated, they start to stretch. As I've said, the fluctuations freeze out when their physical wavelength is of order the horizon size. They then continue to stretch, and the amount they stretch depends on at what time and what value of v, at what time and what value of v they were originally generated. The wavelength of a perturbation at the end of inflation is the inverse Hubble scale, the beginning of inflation, times some exponential factor, and this is monotonic in the time or in the value of phi at which it was generated. So if we want to measure a given fluctuation at some wavelength, we can just measure it at the at some time. We can relate that time to a wavelength or an angular scale in the sky, like so, and this relationship is monotonic. These fluctuations are continually produced and stretch after they are produced, and the result is that we should see fluctuations in phi and in the density at all angular scales on the sky. Finally, the fact that this is changing slowly means that the spectrum should be nearly scale invariant. In the end, one can argue that the strength of density inhomogeneities takes this form. It's related to the Hubble parameter, the time derivative of the scalar field, and the strength of the fluctuations evaluated at the time that the fluctuation first froze out, at the time that the wavelength of the fluctuation was at the Hubble scale. In these simple models, you can relate phi dot h and delta phi to the potential. And so the size of the fluctuations depends on this ratio of a power of the potential divided by its derivative, evaluated when the fluctuation was produced. later on, at the decoupling era, one can then relate this spectrum of density fluctuations to a spectrum of temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And this is in principle computable and depends on known physics after the end of inflation. And there are computer programs one can write to start here and get here. Using this, in particular, COBE was able to measure the power and density fluctuations at the end of inflations, and it was about this big, as predicted by simple models. Another important effect during inflation, which we will use, is that it also produces primordial gravity waves. If I decompose a small fluctuation of the metric into two physical polarizations, I can essentially treat the coefficients of these two polarizations as scalar fields, and classical perturbations of them are generated just as they were for the inflaton, and the strength of the size of the fluctuations is almost the same. There's a factor of M Planck sitting downstairs because of the normalization of the metric. These gravity waves lead to a distinct signature. In general, the cosmic background photons are polarized by Thomson scattering off of the electrons before recombination. As gravity waves pass through the plasma, they give they lead to tensor-like fluctuations of the temperature in the plasma, which arise from the spin two nature of the graviton. The photons which leave these regions and scatter off an electron, the polarization cancels in such a way that I get a unique polarization signature in the cosmic microwave background radiation that comes towards us. So that if we can measure the polarization of the cosmic background photons and measure the right kind of polarization, we can measure the strength of gravity waves that pass through the plasma during recombination. And it turns out that the signal is directly proportional to the square root of the energy density during inflation. So that a measurement of the polarization of the right kind of polarization pattern in the cosmic microwave background radiation would give us a direct measurement of the potential energy during inflation.
Coefficient is supposed to be order one or something?
Yeah, that's right. I just didn't write down the details, but it's computable in order one.
Is it a measure of the scale of decoupling, or it's a measure?
It's a measure of the scale of the time that the fluctuation is generated. That's this dependent. This V is to be evaluated at. So if I measure the strength of the signal at some scale, I figure out
it's the V when it crossed the horizon.
When it crossed the horizon initially during inflation.
So you get a
right.
V as a function of time.
That's right.
As you go through.
That's right. This fact that you can measure V is particularly exciting because, at least in the simplest models of inflation, the magnitude of V was pretty close to the grand unified scale. If I assume that the potential energy takes this form, where M sub 1 is the overall scale of the energy density during inflation, M sub 2 tells you how much phi varies during inflation, and F is a function whose magnitude and derivatives are of order 1. If you demand that that one has a nice slow roll inflationary epoch for long enough for the universe to grow by a factor of e to the 60, and one demands that fluctuations are generated with the strength measured by COBE, one finds that the overall scale and the energy density during inflation is about the gut scale, and that this mass here is a few times the Planck scale, so that the VEV of the scalar field during inflation is about the Planck scale. V keep this latter fact in mind. It will be useful close to the end of, well, it will be relevant close to the end of the talk.
That's very worrisome, right? I mean, the whole framework for inflation used to say, well, we're a few orders of magnitude away from the quantum gravity scale. We don't have to worry about real quantum gravity.
Well, this doesn't tell you that the energy densities are of order of the Planck scale, just that the VEV of the scalar field is close. I mean, this can happen in string theory, too. If there are non-compact directions, this could be some modulus, and there are non-compact directions in that moduli space. It just means that the thing sloshes a lot. So this was something that confused a lot of people. The fact that the VEV is large is not an indication that quantum gravity effects are. Yeah, it's totally ad hoc. Because I'll say, well, in the next slide, I'll mention that it's ad hoc. I'll say something about that in a minute. The second interesting thing is that the upper limits have been set on the strength from non-observation of the right kind of polarization, or any polarization. Upper limits have been set on the energy density during inflation, and they're pretty close to the gut scale. So if, in fact, inflation occurred at this scale, people believe that one should be able to see the signal in the next few years.
What is that bottom limit? H is less than 10 to the 13th?
10 to the 14th GeV. So H is the scale of inflation divided by is crudely V over 3 MP4 squared, like so. So H is slightly smaller than the energy density because of these factors of the four-dimensional Planck scale. That's unfortunately why at the end of the day we won't be quite accessing gut scale physics, because this is the scale at which quantum fluctuations are generated. Now, one problem is that generally to get all of the properties you want, the inflaton potential has to be pretty fine-tuned. A measure of the dimensionless coupling might be the fourth derivative of the energy density, and that's generally the ratio of m sub 1, the overall scale of the potential, to n sub 2, the amount which the scalar field varies, and that's generally a pretty small number, which is hard to explain. There are arguments that, for example, in Herjavec-Witten type compactifications, one naturally gets potentials for moduli of about this order. There are then other problems because you have too many moduli with this kind of potential, but it's because of the way that supersymmetry is broken from n equals 2 to n equals 1 as you go from 5 to 4 dimensions, you can...
How do you get 10 to the
The argument will be that the potential has the form I told you before, that the overall scale is close to 10 to the 16th, and the scalar field should vary over some... That's right. It comes from the fact that in Herjavec-Witten compactifications, I start in 5 dimensions with an n equals 2 theory, and all of the potential, all the scalars are flat, have flat directions. The superpotentials can only arise on the walls, on the E8 walls. And so when you just look at, just do essentially dimensional analysis on the scale that sits in front of the superpotential and on the scale that sits in front of the kinetic terms for the moduli, one finds that you get a potential of that form. So it's the fact that I have an almost supersymmetric theory in the bulk of this interval that keeps the scalars nearly flat. I can show you the argument at the end. It's essentially just dimensional analysis. So the question is finally what the effect of short distance physics might be. Let me rewrite the formula for the density perturbations squared in terms of the two-point function of the inflaton during inflation. And in doing this calculation, note that the relevant dynamical scale is the Hubble scale. So the way to calculate this, if there's new physics above this scale, is to integrate out all of the momenta above the Hubble scale to get some effective action defined at momenta up to the scale, and then use this effective action to compute the two-point function. Nothing very dramatic. And the kind of thing you might have in mind is if you had some fermion coupled normalizably to the inflaton, you could then compute the two-point function by integrating out the fermions like so, one has to do this computation in the sitter space. So there will be corrections of order h squared divided by the momenta squared, which will be much be larger than h to do this. But this is a computation you should be able to do. Now, if you assume that the theory is local at momenta at or below the Hubble scale, the effect of action should be analytic in the momenta and in the curvatures. The curvature during inflation scales is h squared. And the effect of action should take this form. It's the standard quadratic kinetic term. This shift is the shift in the propagator into sitter space. And then I will get corrections, h-dependent momenta corrections, which are really couplings of the curvature to d phi squared, terms which are quartic in the momenta, and so on, are weighted downstairs by the appropriate factors of the UV scale. The result at the end of the day will be a correction to the two. This was the value of the two-point function in de Sitter space, assuming simply a quadratic h-independent kinetic energy term, and these are the correct. This is the correction you will get, which will depend on these two terms. In general, this should be expressible as a power series in h squared over lambda squared.
There's no extra momentum dependence?
No. This at the end you've evaluated it at p equals h.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Do you have to worry about what vacuum you're in?
I think. I think it's pretty, we've just had a lot of arguments about this with Brandenburger. I think it's pretty safe to say that the vacuum should be close to thermal at the Hubble scale. That's the best way to say it. Close to the standard de Sitter, thermal de Sitter vacuum at the Hartle-Hawking vacuum at the de Sitter scale. I mean, you could.
Did you have to pick a vacuum to do this calculation?
Well, we picked that vacuum. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. There will be other people have picked other vacuums which give you effects which, among other things, aren't analytic in h squared over lambda squared. But they're odd. Those vacuums are always odd. They depend on assuming you add all sorts of crazy higher derivative terms. You get effects which are very non-local at the Hubble scale. You get huge energy densities because of particle production. They seem generally to be pretty problematic. So at least that was true in the papers of Brandenburger and the papers of Green that we looked at. I think generally, assuming you have some nice local effective action at the Hubble scale, or assumptions about the vacuum are pretty good. So given this, the effects on the measurable quantities, delta rho over rho, and the power in gravitational waves, these
lambda UV
is some ultraviolet scale, and I'll discuss what that scale is in particular models. You might imagine it would be the mass of, for example, the mass of the fermion that you integrate out if you couple to some fermion. So this was the expression assuming just a simple, assuming the simplest model with the standard quadratic kinetic term. And the expression for delta rho over rho as a function of h now gets modified. And the expression for the fluctuations in gravity waves might also get modified if these degrees of freedom also couple to gravity as you expect them to. So the question is now whether, from actual measurements, we can extract the h dependence of these two observables, what's sometimes called a sub s and a sub t.
You're not going to worry about spectral tilt?
That's exactly what I'm going to worry about. By which I mean, the way to extract this dependence of these parameters on h is to look at the scale dependence on the sky of the temperature fluctuations and of the right kind of polarization signature. And what you usually do is get a map of the temperature on the sky and decompose the temperature fluctuations in spherical harmonics. When L is large enough, this is just clearly the momenta. And when you actually measure it on the sky, you get some complicated spectrum like this. The spectrum produced at the end of the inflation is somewhat simple, but this final result, which is the spectrum during decoupling, depends calculably on this, on post-inflationary physics. One needs to understand the amount of baryonic matter, the amount of dark matter, the dark energy, and so forth, given those parameters, which to some degree you can measure by the heights and spacing of these peaks. One should be able then from this to extract this up to your...
Five parameters.
There are a lot of parameters. But you can get at least some information. The errors, there will be errors on this, which, among other things, depend on the errors on this and so forth. So it's
five parameters that you don't know that you're using that
fit. Yeah. And then you have some other information from other experiments, like supernova and so on and so forth. So, you can get the crudest information about the amount and say some crude information about the scale variance, in principle. Actually, for what I'll talk about, just say I'm interested in pretty much the crudest stuff, although that's hard enough to measure. I'll say exactly what actually in the next transparency. Because of, in the scenarios we're looking at, the scalar field is changing slowly and the Hubble parameter is changing slowly during inflation, and I have a monotonic invertible relation between the wavelength of a fluctuation at the end of inflation and its the value of the scalar field at the time that that perturbation crossed the horizon, or if you like, between this angular wave number. These functions of the measurements of the density fluctuations and the polarization change slowly with L. So I can do a power series expansion of traditionally the log of these quantities in log of L. And the crudest, because...
So why is it log?
Partly you want... for one thing, A sub S and A sub T are already small, so you want to sort of divide out by this fact that the original signal is small and to see what the scale invariance is. If I have some plot, I'm getting rid of the overall height and just asking about the slope. Yeah, that's right. It's a choice, and it's a conventional choice. The inflation, the things we expect to, we can hope to observe at any time in the near future, are the simplest coefficients here, this coefficient of log L, which is known as the scalar tilt, the coefficient in log A sub T of log L, which is the tensor tilt, nu sub S, and that's probably about all. The signals are fairly weak. The scale invariance is expected to be fairly weak because of slow roll. So these numbers aren't expected to be very large, and one has to worry about all of the different errors, including the fundamental error of sample that's given to you by cosmic variance.
I would think the extra momentum dependence of your correlation function.
I'll tell you exactly what that does. That's the point. In fact, I'll do it in this transparency. So the point is that exactly because the L dependence relates to the dependence on phi, if we have some particular theoretical input, the dependence on A sub S of V and the derivative, and the dependence on A sub T of just V, and if we have the experimental input of the coefficients of this power series, we could, in principle, reconstruct the dependence of the potential on phi. When you do this, you find that for any value of V sub phi, there is a consistency condition between the coefficients of this power series, in particular between the tensor tilt and the ratio of the tensor to scalar power. This consistency condition is then modified by the kind of effect that we're discussing, by this correction to the propagator. So if you could measure N sub T, A sub T, and A sub S, you could see what this coefficient kappa is, some calculated coefficient. But if you can measure this sufficiently precisely, you should be able to see that there's some sort of violation. And that's the effect that we're talking about. That's, in the end, the simplest observable effect of new physics.
What's kappa?
Kappa is some dimensionless, I forget off the top of my head. It involves two pis and eight.
What about
non-Gaussianity should be in particular sensitive to the form of V. Those signals are generally very small, partly because V has to be weakly curved. So the V has to be sufficiently shallow, all the couplings are small, and you don't expect the signal coming from non-Gaussianity to be very large. We thought about it a little and decided it was too small to be useful to us at present, but I haven't thought about it. I haven't thought about it in detail. Yeah, it's, yes. Well, I'll tell you, I'll give you an estimate of this.
Which I think is your.
To some degree, yeah. I'll give you an estimate of how, where we think we can in principle, what we think we can in principle measure.
One other question before you go on.
I think that's even small, that other effect is even smaller by orders of magnitude. So.
I think you said that whatever V of phi you get a consistency
condition. This consistency condition holds for any V of phi. And it's just the fact that basically A sub s depends on V and D of V, A sub t depends on V. So if I look at the overall number at some scale and then the first derivative at each, I have four coefficients and three parameters. So there's a relation.
You don't need to put in 60 E foldings or
bounds. Once I have V, this is just true. That's right. There are corrections to this in terms of V. There are corrections to this which are calculable as functions of V, which are of the same order of this. But they will depend on, you can write this all in terms of the different inflationary observables. And so you will have, given V, you will have some expression like this with some higher order terms here, which is all calculable in terms of the inflationary observables. And then you'll have this correction, which is new. So the problem is that these measurements are fairly hard to do. The signals are very small, and they compete with just strong. The detector noise competes strongly with them, and the astrophysical foregrounds and backgrounds also compete. And secondly, there is the issue of cosmic invariance, the fact that there's only one observable universe, so that your measurement on a given angular scale is restricted by the fact that I can only get enough measurements to cover the sky once. Since it turns out the signal is larger at lower angular scales, this is a real issue, exactly at the point where your experiments are most sensitive, or the point at which you hit up against these fundamental limits. So we just did an estimate of what we could see after looking at a bunch of papers and snowmass reports and so forth on polarization experiments. And we found that generally post-inflationary physics sharply reduces the polarization signal outside of this window. And if we take the most optimistic scenario that within this window we can do cosmic variance limited measurements of A sub t, we find that we can detect this coefficient if it's greater than about 1%. This is optimistic. I'd be talking about like a 10 plus year time frame. But
what did you assume for sensitivity? Just assume you're completely cosmic variance
limited? We assume that we're completely cosmic variance limited in this window.
Okay. That's right. Nothing about sensitivity beyond that.
That's right. That's right. Obviously, if you have things. Yeah. So if you, for example, if there was some gravity wave experiment which could detect things at very, very, what correspond to very short angular scales, then you'd have this huge lever arm. But so far, nothing that's being planned is sensitive enough, I think.
So basically a perfect map between those
elements. Yeah, that's right. That's what we're assuming. And so, I mean, experimentalists tell us that that's hard, but it's not totally insane. So we're being optimistic within those limits. At least the couple that we talked to. So given this relation, if we can measure this above 1%, and we take the best case scenario that this ratio is less than 1/15, we find in general that new physics will be observable if this expression here is of the order 10% to order 1. So for the end of my talk, I will then just talk about a series of models and ask whether effects of this size can ever be produced. So the first thing we looked at before we we started looking at before we really had a sense of what the numbers were four-dimensional field theories, something like a gut model, assuming that at this scale, all the interactions are renormalizable and any non-renormalizable actions are suppressed by the four-dimensional Planck scale. Now, the kind of effect, the kind of thing you can imagine, as I said before, was some coupling between phi and some extremely massive fermion. But now recall that the vacuum expectation value of phi is about the four-dimensional Planck scale during inflation. So this pushes the mass of the fermion up. And you find at the end of the day that this expression is less than this ratio, h squared over m Planck 4 squared, which is 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 10. So this is totally unobservable.
Are you going to discuss what the effect will be in terms of C sub L or not?
Well, it's the I take C sub L and I pull out the tensor and scalar tilts. And it was the violation of there's this consistency condition which holds for the standard inflationary scenarios, the relation between ignoring this. This relation holds without our scenario.
Have you assumed only one model for the power spectrum when this effect does not occur? So that can you distinguish this effect from other effects?
That's the, oh, there are other effects that violate this consistency condition. Is that what you're asking?
No.
Yeah, the point is that this effect holds for any model and any potential that you write down for the inflaton.
That's for single field inflation?
Yeah, single field inflation, and so with hybrid inflation, it depends on detail. I'll talk about hybrid inflation at the end.
I'm wondering is whether you can actually uniquely identify this as the effect from some other model or for some other
I'll talk about that at the end. In particular, in models with multiple scalar fields, you can get an effect like this. But those, to get that effect, you have to do some pretty unnatural things from a field theory point of view.
But any, I'll be honest, any astrophysics that comes in,
You have to worry. You have to. But this isn't an issue of extracting the simple curve from the complicated, this complicated spectrum that you get, and also in extracting, getting rid of all the foreground stuff. So, that's we are assuming that you can deal with most of that. It's an assumption. But. One notable exception in this four-dimensional example, although this requires a certain degree of fine-tuning, I'll just mention it in passing, is that if the mass of this fermion goes to zero at some time during the inflationary epoch, in string theory you can imagine passing through some Hanifold point or something, then the physics will notably change at a scale corresponding to phi naught. And so you'll get a feature in A sub t and A sub s at this scale. And this feature was discussed somewhat by Chung and Kolb and company. So the last question is whether we can increase this effect in some model which has a 4D effective field theory description. And one way to do that is if this to make this big is to make this coefficient big. For example, if a lot of particles couple to the inflaton. Now, this isn't so natural in four-dimensional gut models, but you can imagine it in higher-dimensional theories. The loop integral here should include a sum over Kaluza-Klein momenta. If I turn it into a momentum sum, the sum is generally divergent and is dominated by the cutoff, which should occur because of supersymmetry or because of the softness in string theory. And the effect will, in general, be to push this ratio up to the ratio of h squared to the fundamental Planck scale in 10 or 11 dimensions. So this is effect would then be observable if this fundamental Planck scale is close to h. And there are models which do this for you. First, let me just dispense with the standard string or M-theory guts. In weakly coupled string theory, the string scale is usually close to the gut scale. This coefficient includes the string coupling, which is usually weak. So this effect would be rather small, of order 10 to the minus 6. Similarly, with M-theory models, the fundamental scale is close to the gut scale. So this is a bit better than the four-dimensional gut scenario, but it's still unobservable. So the last question we asked ourselves was whether you could imagine any models at all which are observable due to a lower Planck scale. We gave ourselves some constraints. We wanted to get the correct four-dimensional Planck scale as a function of the 10 or 11-dimensional Planck scale and the volume of the compactification manifold. Because we were looking at scales about 10 to the 14th, which aren't too far off 10 to the 16th, we still want the gauge couplings to be of order a 25th, so that when we run them down to a TV, we get crudely the right gauge couplings. And we wanted to assume that the quantum dynamics of the inflaton is four-dimensional, which means that the Kaluza-Klein momenta should be larger than the characteristic temperature of the vacuum that we're using, which is about h over 2 pi. And finally, if we assume that the energy density in four dimensions is smeared out over the extra dimensions, we wanted to make sure that the energy density wasn't larger than the d-dimensional Planck scale.
The reason you're running the 3 comes from scale distribution.
Yeah, it's this factor of 3. It's this factor of 3. So if we, point number 3. We just gave ourselves a constraint that we wanted inflation to be four-dimensional so that all the formula we were using were true. You could also try to relax this constraint, although I'm not sure how things would work. In the end, this ends up being a constraint of about the same order in the observable models. In particular, the N3 models that we look at are the kinds of models you might call brain world models. The gauge degrees of freedom propagate on some brain or some singularity with codimension k. So I can write down the d minus k dimensional manifold on which gauge dynamics propagates as R4 times some submanifold of the compactification manifold. The gauge coupling then depends on the d-dimensional Planck scale and the volume of the submanifold, like so. The four-dimensional Planck scale still has this dependence. I will also define V sub k as the ratio of the volume of the compactification manifold to the volume of the submanifold. And I can write down a dimensionless measure of the mass divided by the the Kaluza-Klein scale as the d-dimensional Planck scale. So the point is that we can rewrite crudely the four-dimensional Planck scale as the d-dimensional Planck scale times this volume of the transverse manifold. Using this constraint and this constraint, and the fact that this is fixed, this dimensionless guy is fixed by the gauge coupling, this places lower limits on the d-dimensional Planck scale via this. It turns out the larger the codimension of the brain is, the lower we can push the d-dimensional Planck scale. So in particular, in Herjavec-Witten type scenarios, the codimension of the singularity which supports gauge dynamics is 1, and we can't push down the 11-dimensional Planck scale enough. The best we can do, subject to these constraints, is for that scale to be about 6 times 10 to the 15th GeV. So this is still 10 to the minus 4. But compactifications with G2 holonomy are somewhat more isotropic. And it turns out that we can push the 11-dimensional Planck scale in these models, subject to all of our constraints, down to about the Hubble scale. So in these models, these effects are observable.
The constraint of the Hubble scale came again from non-observation of polarization. I
mean, we are assuming the Hubble scale is of order. We're just assuming that it's as high as it can be, and then asking.
Pushing down the fundamental Planck scale doesn't change that. It only depends on the four-dimensional Planck scale.
Well, it would change things if you had an explicit model.
So these are so close that you would think that it seems like.
Yeah, the point is that we can. Well, we're using a lower limit. There are lower limits on the energy density during inflation, set by the fact that inflation is. You want the energy density in 11 dimensions to be sub-Planckian, and it turns out that the energy density is related to the Hubble scale, and that ends up relating to a relation between the Hubble scale and the 11-dimensional Planck scale. Does that make sense? The energy density is going to be h squared times m Planck 4 squared.
Yes.
And so we're asking that divided by the 11-dimensional. And then you want to make that an 11-dimensional energy density and make sure that divided by the 11-dimensional Planck scale is not larger than 1. And that's basically the constraint that operates here. I mean, the problem is that here, the nice arguments that you had for getting a nice weak inflationary potential don't, in Herjavec Witten or G2 scenarios, don't really hold here. So you have to imagine some other way of getting it. But this is all pretty crude and. Yeah, that's right. Well, there's also, well, as I will, always a step ahead of me. you have to, I mean, these aren't pretty models. You lose precision grand unification. You have to start worrying about proton decay. In particular, any baryon number violating dimension six operators are now give you proton lifetimes, which are way too small. Dimension seven and above, at least at the crudest level, is okay. But anyway, they're models that only, well, I won't say only a mother can love, because my mom knows better. But so, but there are at least models in string theory which give you these. So I want to leave you with a few concluding remarks. One question is whether there are any competing effects. In particular, if there are multiple scalar fields, the inflaton plus some other scalar fields, and the potential energy in these directions is also weak, then the fluctuations in these scalar fields may also contribute to delta T over T. It'll give you what's called isocurvature type perturbations. And depending on the trajectory of the vacuum expectation value of these guys during inflation, so imagine this baseline is phi and this is sigma. If I have some screwy trajectory like this, I can get other corrections to these consistency conditions. But this requires additional fine-tuning of both the potential and of the initial conditions for these scalar fields. So it's certainly possible that field theoretically it's not totally natural. The second comment I want to make is that it would be nice to have, for this calculation, better control of explicit models, some ability to calculate what are, in the end, D-terms in M-theory compactified on manifolds of G2 holonomy, or another brain world models which give you similar effects, F3 models, other models involving D-brains on Clausius manifolds. The hope is that you could compute this explicitly. Perhaps if you're lucky, this coefficient is enhanced by some interesting model-dependent effect. You might also, in these models, be able to get a better handle on what the effects of other scalar fields might be. You might be able to see whether they would give you something interesting and observable. Finally, I'll just raise the question of whether there are other astrophysical probes of new physics. This that I'll talk about isn't really high energy, but at least it's different from the standard model. For example, we know that about 30% of the universe is made up of dark matter, which is non-baryonic. We can get properties of it from cosmic background radiation, galactic dynamics, gravitational lensing data. The nature of the dark matter affects not only the cosmic background radiation and structure formation, and detailed properties, such as the way that the dark matter interacts with itself, can affect structure even on subgalactic scales. For example, if one assumes that it interacts sufficiently strongly, it can smooth out structure on subgalactic scales. There is an apparent mismatch between the structure at those scales that you see in simulations and the structure that you actually observe, which you could try to fix. But also, you can turn this around and say, given a dark matter candidate, you can use galactic and subgalactic structure to test the properties of that candidate. So I'll just leave that as another possibility for testing new physics. And close and ask if there are more questions. Yeah?
So I guess I have a general question about the philosophy here. So would you say just the fact that we've seen these anisotropies and this cosmic background radiation is already, you know, a probe of high energy physics in the sense that it's telling us about, you know, this inflation at 10 to the 14th?
If in fact inflation occurred at that high of a scale. That's not known yet, and you need to measure polarization to say that for sure.
Oh, inflation could have occurred at a much lower scale.
Yeah. Delta, what we've measured is delta rho over rho. And basically, this is up to factors of 2 pi and stuff. So we can lower V by making the slope small. And there are models that people have written down where the scale is quite low. There are models, you know, there was an industry trying to get the scale to be close to the 10 to the 12th GeV, the the scale that supersymmetry would be broken in some hidden sector scenario. And you can try to lower it. Yeah. So there are various models. And so for this to be a test of physics at that scale, one would need the scale to be high. Also, this is a measurement of fluctuations of the inflaton. Polarization would give you actual quantum fluctuations of gravity directly.
But I guess my comment or question was, I mean, we're sort of taking this all for granted, that we have this basic high energy effect, and then you get small.
I'm assuming that the scale of inflation was high, and asking if it is in fact this high, is it really a good probe of high scale physics? If it's much lower, then unfortunately the gravity wave signal is unobservable, and it probably won't be so useful.
Any more questions? One second, I'll be in there.